Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello, I'm David Padil.
I'm Saida Farsi, and this is A Muslim and a Jew Go There.
And this week, well, in a bit, we're going to be talking about Iran and Australia, which sounds like a dull World Cup fixture. But no, we're going to be talking about Iran attacking Israel and the feeling that might lead to World War III and terrible violence happening in Australia and how that was misinterpreted over here. But before we get there, there's been some news just in, hasn't there, Saida?
Yes, there has. The High Court has just issued a judgment in the Michaela School case. And just to recap, this is the Michaela School in Wembley, where a Muslim student had taken the school to court, challenging the school's ban on prayer. And the judgment that has just come in is that the school did not discriminate against this child and that the head teacher's decision was considered by the court to be proportionate. So this raises some fascinating questions about the space for religion and religious practice within state secular schools.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on with it. Catherine Birbal Singh, is that her name? Catherine
Birbal Singh, right? If you pronounce
Birbal
it properly.
Birbal Singh, yeah. Is quite a big figure on social media and in the press. She's become known as running the country's strictest school, Michaela. Pupils are not allowed to talk in between lessons when they're walking in the corridor, and they have to have rote learning. So, and she's very keen on what she would call conservative values, like yourself, Saida, which she says with a small c, but her statement that she made today about winning this case, I think, said the word conservative values, the phrase, at least twice, possibly three times. And she also finished it, which really made me laugh out loud, by saying, God save the king. And I guess it made me laugh out loud, partly just because it was, like, weirdly 1930s, but also because you've just been talking for this whole thing about how God isn't meant to be a thing at your school, and now you've mentioned him. I thought, so that just made me laugh.
It is unusual. I mean, she's been around, I suppose, the Conservative Party and conservative political circles for a while. She's an interesting character. And what she argues is that having this incredibly unusual but strict routine in schools means that the school performs very well. And one of the things she talks about is making sure that all the kids don't have anything that divides them and that there should be this kind of cohesive community in schools, which actually, in theory, sounds great, but in practice has been interpreted in some really unusual ways, which raises questions about how much power and authority a single person like a head teacher can have in a school in setting what is and isn't allowed as far as religious practice is concerned. So, for example, you're allowed to wear a turban in this school. You're allowed to wear a hijab. You're allowed to wear other religious symbols. So, you know, Hindu religious symbols, Jewish religious symbols. Nobody's allowed to eat meat. So everybody has to follow a strict vegetarian diet.
Isn't that partly, as far as I understand it, that's not because they are pro-vegetarian. It's because they're trying to create a menu that no particular religion would object to. I think that is to try and foster a kind of spirit whereby the various different cultures, and there are lots of different ones at that school, are all okay with the food, and vegetarian food is the easiest one to do that with. I think that's what's going on.
I think it's all about cohesion, although what was also reported was that during the month of fasting, during Ramadan, pupils who were fasting had to sit at the table during lunchtime with other pupils who were eating and drinking and just had to sit there and watch them because
apparently that is true.
So that was, yeah, I was talking to one of the reporters who was reporting on this today, and I just found that really unusual.
Okay, that is unusual and sounds weird, I have to say. Just to sort of put my cards on the table, I'm sort of with her to some extent, and not as a Jew, but as an atheist. And as a sort of secular atheist person, I'm kind of with her, because I think that religion in general, even though I went to a very Orthodox Jewish faith school, which was not helpful probably in terms of my own personal psychological damage, but I'm not sure about the whole idea of religion and schools. Having said that, I think you have to be sensible And it seems to me to be, if kids are really hungry because of their religion, then they shouldn't be made to sit and watch other people eat. That would drive them mad, I would have thought.
I think for me, so I agree with her as well. I agree with her as a conservative because I do think that quite a formal conservative routine within schools is better for the learning experience. And if what we end up with is much better behaved kids and we end up with better results, that's got to be a positive. And anything that brings pupils together and creates a sense of unity among school is good. The bit that I worry about is how a single person can become the arbiter of religiosity. So what this court judgment says is that we're going to leave this judgment to individual head teachers. And that really relies upon the fact that all our head teachers are going to be incredibly measured and inclusive and thoughtful and sane. But if we leave all of that power in one person's hand and they make the decision about which bits of religion they're going to allow in their school, that's a really dangerous space to be, because we have to have a clear understanding in school. Either we have a completely secular system like the French system, which we don't, but we move towards that system where effectively all religion is barred from all state schools, or we have a clear understanding of what schools must accommodate. We can't do it on a piecemeal basis based upon the whims and the wishes of individual head teachers. I find that really disturbing.
I think we just need to go over one or two other elements of this case that are important. What has been suggested, at least by the head teacher, is that it was disruptive, the praying. That's what she was suggesting. I'm not saying that's true, but that is what she was saying. She was saying that it wasn't just one pupil, that it ended up with 30 pupils who tended to put their blazers or create some kind of prayer mat outside in the playground. And her suggestion was that this led to a situation where other pupils felt intimidated, including other Muslim pupils who were not as religious, but felt, you know, that meant that they, because they weren't praying, that maybe that they felt peer group pressure or whatever. And she refers to quite worrying things, types of intimidation. She says that one black teacher, she says, was racially abused, and another teacher had a brick come through the window of their house. Presumably, the suggestion is, though she doesn't actually say this out loud, from parents of or people who felt that it was Islamophobic of her to be doing this banning of the prayer. Is that correct?
I think that she's an interesting character. And I said that right at the beginning. And you know, I think all of this kind of publicity is certainly not going to do her any harm. But what I do think is the concern for me is, rather than kind of making this personal about these individuals, what worries me is what the consequences of this will be for the state school system. Because what she says in her statement today is, if the pupils don't like what I'm doing at this school, they can just go off and find another school. So get lost if you don't like what I'm doing, go find yourself another school. The worry for me is that if every head teacher took the decision that, for example, nobody could pray within school hours, that effectively means that Muslim pupils particularly, who obviously have their five prayers a day if they are religious, which includes some of those times are during school times, are being excluded from the state system. Because if every head teacher did what Catherine Birbal Singh is doing, which is, if you don't like it, lump it, off you go, we are effectively saying to pupils, well, actually, if you think your religion is important and you want to practice your religion, and five prayers a day is one of the five pillars, it's not some kind of abstract part of the faith, it's an integral part of the faith, then there is no space for you within the state system. And that decision is just going to be made by a head teacher in each of these schools.
Yeah, I get that. I get that you're worried about that. But I just want to drill down on something which I said, which is, and I'm just trying to think myself into being a head teacher, where I guess the most important thing is overall happiness, overall cohesion, overall calmness at a school. And I'm obviously not a Muslim, so I'm going to ask you a question. But what I am actually is someone who knows what it's like to be a non-religious Jew around religious Jews. So I do know what it's like to be someone who might feel that I'm somehow, you know, being sinful, failing when I'm seeing people who are observant. Do you think it is possibly true? She did say this quite a lot, that she felt that other Muslims who were not as observant were feeling intimidated by those Muslim children who did decide to pray in the playground?
I can only give you my own personal experience, David. And I suppose I've never felt intimidated to be religious or intimidated not to be religious. But I think for me, the issue is the precedence that you set when you are running a public sector organization. And I felt like we've become a much more inclusive, accommodating nation. This feels like a weird backward step. And I think that if a good school is run by a good leader who tries to make the widest possible accommodations so that the pupils that they are teaching feel that they're learning in an environment which sees them and hears them and includes them and values them. And actually, there is an accommodation at the moment for sixth formers, for example, who actually go offsite at this school, at the Michaela School, and they go and pray at the Brent Civic Centre. So in the past, there have been accommodations. And I just think it's sad. I mean, look, on this particular case, in these particular individual school, it may well be that they lose some pupils and other pupils who aren't that bothered about praying will join the school. My worry is that this is a lot of power in the hands of single leaders and single leaders who could go off and start making all sorts of mad decisions and effectively create a hostile space for some pupils.
One thing I do think, which is, again, interesting, because I think I don't know exactly where I sit on this one, even though my instincts are, you know, that education and religion don't necessarily mix. But I found that the student's statement, I don't know if you've read it, I found it very sympathetic. Because I'll tell you why, because I think it sounds like a young person. She says, I don't agree that it would be too hard for the school to accommodate pupils who wish to pray in the lunch break. This is the bit I find moving. She says, the school is very well run and generally very good at managing everything. The school doesn't wish to allow pupils to pray. It's chosen a different path than the judge has found in its favour. Even though I lost, I still feel that I did the right thing. I tried my best and was true to myself and my religion. And now, of course, my heart goes out to that student, even though another part of me thinks, well, I think the head teacher is trying to do something secular, and I am essentially a secularist.
I think that statement from the pupil is really powerful, because I'm really proud of the fact that she felt she could assert her views and that she believed in the court system and she was taking part in democracy. And I'm also really pleased that actually, despite challenging the school in this way, her younger sibling is going to continue to go to the Michaela School. I suppose in some ways it shows democracy in action.
I'm now wondering if when I was a kid, which was obviously 2,000 years ago, going to my very Orthodox Jewish primary school, if my parents had brought a case against that school saying David doesn't want to wear a yarmulke or funny little, they're called a tzitzit, funny little internal vest, and he doesn't want to eat kosher food because it's often disgusting, we're going to go to court about it, whether or not I would have won. I doubt it in 1973.
I think the school would have said, what the hell are you doing at a Jewish school then, mate? Off you go.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
You well, have you an that, identity crisis.
That's true, but I think that is, to some extent, Catherine Burble Singh's point the other way around. Anyway, we're going to talk about something, having talked about something fairly local, certainly to me, because Wembley's quite near where I live, we're going to talk about something much more global, which is Iran attacking Israel.
You see, I'm going to stop you right there, David. We're going to disagree.
Oh, we haven't even said anything yet.
You said Iran attacking Israel. I would say Iran responding to Israel's attack.
Well, yeah, I think they still attacked Israel, in the same way that I might be someone who'd said that Israel were responding to Hamas's attack when they attacked Gaza.
But if you punch me on the nose and I punch you back, I'm not attacking you, I'm responding.
Right, carry on.
So let me go back to where this started, which is that on the 1st of April, in the midst of everything that's going on in Gaza, Israel decided that it was going to attack the Iranian consulate in Damascus, and 7 members of the Revolutionary Guard were killed in that attack. And as a result of that, Iran took the matter to the United Nations. It asked the United Nations to issue a condemnation of that. Russia raised that as a statement to the United Nations Security Council. It was vetoed, obviously, and it didn't pass. Interestingly, the European Union did condemn that attack, but because it wasn't widely condemned and it wasn't condemned at the UN, Iran decided that it was going to respond to that because it was, according to the Vienna Convention, an attack on its sovereignty by attacking a diplomatic post. You might know, David, that under the Vienna Convention, diplomatic bags, diplomatic sites, diplomatic buildings, diplomatic people are all protected and are considered to be off limits and sacrosanct.
Of course I knew that, especially diplomatic bags. You knew that, that all sorts of attaché cases and handbags are, in fact, sacrosanct under the Geneva Convention. Vienna Convention, obviously, I knew that.
Are you in Vienna at the moment? You should know that.
I am actually in Vienna at the moment. So look, well, we might as well dig into some of this stuff. It's very, very big conversation because it involves the geopolitics of the whole region, which are very complicated. I know a little bit about Iran, partly through my friend Omid Jalili, the comedian who has spent a lot of time recently. He's an British-Iranian, but he's also spent a lot of time recently talking on social media about some of the terrible things going on in Iran, especially the way that they're treating their women there. But you began by responding very strongly to me because I described it as Iran attacking Israel without necessarily thinking about that. And what that brings up is something that I've read quite a lot, which is, you know, why did Israel hit that Damascus embassy? And either they just did it because there were members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard there who may or may not have been involved in sending arms to Hezbollah, certainly would have been enemies of the Israeli state, and they just wanted to kill them. Or for those who would always read deviousness into the workings of the Israeli government, they were trying to widen the conflict in order to, you know, draw attention away from Gaza, in order to make it clear, perhaps, to the Americans, knowing that Iran would respond, that they have to keep sending arms to Israel. What do you think about that?
I would say it's probably a little bit of both. I think what's interesting is that that Israel has always used, as have other countries, this concept of targeted killing, extrajudicial killing. And it has over, you know, most of the last few decades. And in fact, the numbers, interestingly, have been going up. So between 2000 and 2018, Israel conducted at least 1,800 such operations, these targeted assassinations. And this is based upon evidence by an Israeli journalist by the name of Ronan Bergman. But what's interesting is that there hasn't always been beef, you know, between Israel and Iran. People think that these countries are like eternal enemies. And interestingly, Iran was the second country in the Muslim world to recognize Israel as a state.
This was when Iran was under control of one of the Shahs, presumably.
Yeah, under the monarchy.
And not presently, as it is now, an Islamic government that very much doesn't recognize Israel, right?
No. And interestingly, even after the revolution in 1979, when Ayatollah Khomeini took over, even after that moment, there was a relationship between Iran and Israel. And one of the, well, there are a number of reasons for that, because both Israel and Iran consider themselves to be different to the rest of that region because they're not part of the Arab world. You know, Iranians do not consider themselves to be part of the Arab world. Israelis do not consider themselves to be part of the Arab world. There's also
Israelis do. Just one small caveat there, which I have said before, which is that there are a lot, something like 20%. Of Israelis, Arab Israelis. So they do consider themselves part of the Arab world, those people.
Yeah, and actually they do. But actually, interestingly, where there was a general Arab nationalist movement in the region, both Israel and Iran saw themselves as distinct to that, but also opposed that. There's also a little bit of a superiority complex, I think, both in Iran and Israel. They're quite similar in the sense that they do believe that they're chosen people and have these great, wonderful civilizations, unlike the Arabs, who they don't consider to be as superior as them. And interestingly, both of them also have this minority mindset of being under siege, that we have been persecuted over many generations. And just like Israel sees itself as the keeper of Jews worldwide, Iran sees itself as the keeper of Shia Muslims worldwide. So for two countries that actually don't get on very well, there's a lot of interesting similarities to their psyche.
Engaging with that, it's possibly leaping forward with what you're going to say, but I wonder if any other Jews felt this, you know, particularly because obviously it's been solidly negative for Israel for a long time, much of it justifiably, you know, just a sort of negative associations about Israel. For a moment, firstly, there seemed to be more sympathy with Israel when the 300 missiles were sent over there. But also the thing that I found vaguely cheering, possibly in a dysfunctional way, was the fact that Jordan and Saudi Arabia all helped to shoot down the drones, causing some consternation, I think, particularly in Jordan. I think there was a lot of people who were angry with the Jordanian government for doing that. But if I tell you what it seemed to me, it seemed to me like things are never as straightforward as they seem. That the idea that Arab governments would, even at this time, decide that they are going to help out with the defence of Israel. I think they said, oh, well, this is our airspace that's being traduced. But I think it was more than that, wasn't it? It wasn't just that. There's this weird sense that Iranians doing that to other parts of the Middle East is also considered to be an intrusion, right?
I think there was something even more interesting than that. And that was that this was orchestrated theatre, that Iran, you know, sent all of these missiles across, wanting every one of them to fail. It wasn't like we sent something over without any notice. The fact that Iran practically rang all the capitals and said, at this time, on this day, we're going to be sending these missiles over. And by the way, it's going to take them 7 hours to get there. So you can be waiting for them and you can shoot them all down. So the RAF were ready for them, quite rightly, to shoot them down, as was the US. The Jordanian airspace was cleared. The Saudi airspace was cleared. It was all just orchestrated theatre. I think it was Iran basically saying, you invaded our sovereignty by bombing one of our consulates. So we're now going to have to react to show you that this is what we're going to do in return. They're all going to be shut down, which is why, interestingly, once that's done, they then issued a statement saying, well, you know, you did what you did, we've done what we've done. And as far as we're concerned, I paraphrase, that's the end of the matter.
I mean, you're right. Almost all the missiles were intercepted. There was a young Arab Bedouin girl, I think, who was hit by shrapnel. But as you say, you know, even though 300 missiles were sent, which obviously could have wreaked a lot of devastation, it did seem to be very peculiar, as you say, mainly theatrical, mainly just maybe aimed at their own population to say, look, we are attacking the Zionist regime. We don't obviously want any kind of big war, but we are doing it. So, you know, come out and wave flags about that.
I don't think actually it was just for their own population. It was really on the international scene to say, you did something, we have to respond, we've responded, and that's the end of it. And interestingly, even Israel's biggest allies with the United Kingdom and the United States said, okay, well, let's all calm down now and let's move on. And
Israel have said they will respond at some point. Anyway, can I just ask you about something you said, which I was really interested by, which was you said that the RAF were involved in shooting down the Iranian drones, as they should be. I'm quite surprised you said that. I read an article by Simon Jenkins in which he said, you know, that he didn't think Britain had any reason to be assisting Israel in this particular conflict at all, including in the shooting down of drones. Now, I guess that what Britain and America would say is that if those missiles had properly landed and destroyed Tel Aviv or whatever, then we probably would be in World War III, and that's why the RAF is trying to stop that happening. But you think that's fine? You think that Britain helping Israel in that particular case is something that they should have done?
I think we had no choice but to stop this escalating. And the fact that the Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, has been speaking to his counterpart in Iran and in Israel over the last few weeks and the last few days was all about us being fully aware of what they were going to do and what they expected us to do in response. Do I think it was a good use of money? No, I don't, right? I don't think at a time when we have our own. Yeah, I don't think at a time when we have our own cost of living crisis, we should be spending, you know, millions of pounds putting our jets in the air to shoot down missiles. But I think if what it did was it calmed the situation down and it meant that Britain is now saying, look, we've done that. Let's everybody calm down now and let's go back to what the real issue is. And this is what I want to talk about, that the amount of missiles that Iran sent to Israel is about a tenth of the amount of missiles that regularly rain down on Gaza without any jets stopping those missiles going in and without an Iron Dome protecting the population of Gaza. And what we need to do is get back to what this is about, which is we should be putting our energies into getting a ceasefire and moving towards a political process between Israel and Palestine.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I want to ask you something else, which is that I saw some people at a protest cheering on Iran in the same way that I've seen people at protests cheering on the Houthis, because it's seen as like, you know, here at least is a country that's prepared to fight back against Israel, even if they're only prepared to shadow box against Israel or whatever in the case of Iran. What do you think about that? What do you think about the fact that, you know, in the weird my enemy's enemy is my friend way that some of the protests work. Not everyone in the protests, of course, but in the people who want to cheer on the Houthis or want to cheer on Iran, particularly in the case of Iran, this is a very terrible regime. It's a terrible theocratic regime that is killing women for not wearing hijabs, that has an appalling record in human rights and towards gay people and all the rest of it. Some people will still decide they're the good guys because they're, you know, attacking the Zionist entity, as I believe they would call it. How do you feel about that?
I think it's completely nonsensical to think that Iran is a regime that we think somehow represents our values. But then, you know, I don't think that Israel currently has a regime in place that represents our values. I actually think political tensions that are being created by two countries where each of them is in some way trying to cement its own kind of political position in their own countries. So what I keep saying is we need to get back to what this issue is about, which is that there are, you know, 1.8 million people on the brink of famine, that there are 33,000 people now dead, most of them women and children.
No, I agree. But it's not irrelevant that it's happened, not least because Hamas are a proxy for Iran. Hezbollah are a proxy for Iran. They don't. That doesn't mean they completely operate under Iran's control, as far as I understand it. We know that Iran supply weapons to Hamas and they supply weapons to Hezbollah. And to some extent, they are involved in the control of what those entities do. So it's not the case that Iran is just an irrelevance. Iran is involved.
Absolutely. And what's also interesting, I think, for us to understand is that the relationship between Iran and Hezbollah and Iran and Hamas and Iran and the Houthis isn't a black and white we're mates issue. There have been times in recent history where they've been at completely different spaces in a war, both in Syria and in Yemen. They were on different sides. They've had fallouts. And so I think these are useful allies for Iran. I know I sound like a broken record, David, and you're going to say, you always come back to this. For me, all of these political issues, this kind of shadow game that we're playing in the international arena, goes back to occupation. And if we find a way to end the occupation, most of these disputes will then have to step away. And I think the most positive thing, and you mentioned it earlier, was the way in which, you know, the Muslim world around Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, you know, none of them were cheering on for Iran. They were kind of saying, okay, well, you've done that. Now pack it in and behave.
Yeah, but this is where there is a faint glimmer of hope, right? Because, you know, the normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which was supposed to be happening just before October the 7th. And there was some suggestion that Iran did inspire Hamas to do the attack in order to disrupt that, because Iran hates Saudi Arabia and doesn't want it to normalize relations with Israel. But I would like to think that if more normalization of relations could happen between Israel and its Arab countries, with a view to that normalization running parallel to a Palestinian state happening, then that's the way forward for peace.
I completely agree with you, David.
It has to happen with the neighbouring countries, those neighbouring countries saying, OK, we will recognise Israel, we will trade with Israel, we'll have a normal relationship with this country as long as there's a Palestinian state. And it does seem to me that Iran wants to stop that, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree with you that in the end, the only way that the normalization in the region will continue and will work is if the existence of a Palestinian state is part and parcel of that normalization. The only thing I would challenge is, and this has been challenged in the United States as well, the intel community accept that what Hamas did was actually not on the orders of Iran.
Right.
And this is now accepted. But in the end, David, they all act on their own self-interest. You know, people think that there's this homogenized Muslim community and they all act in unison and they've all got the same interest. No, they haven't, which is why I'm constantly pleading with friends in Israel to say, if there's ever a moment to find peace, it is now. These countries want peace with you. And by the way, in the last few months, Pakistan and Iran exchanged a few missiles as well. They exchanged a few blows in the last few months as well. And again, it shows you how everybody's got beef with everybody else.
Yeah. I think we have to move on, but we'll definitely be coming back to that. I'm also pleased that you mentioned your boyfriend, Lord Cameron, during that.
Oh, God, here we go again.
We'll be back with you after this short break.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Welcome back to A Muslim and a Jew Go There.
So a very serious thing happened, and in fact wouldn't necessarily concern us because the person involved was neither Muslim nor Jewish, but people thought that he was. And I'm talking about the attack in Sydney last Saturday. There was an attack in Bondi, and in a Westfield in Bondi, where a man who attacked, I think, killed six people, five women and one man. It was an awful, terrible attack. Before we get on to how it was misinterpreted, I think there's a thing that happens, isn't there, which is that as Jews and Muslims, we see these attacks happening and they feel like they concern us, don't they, in different ways. I think you probably think of it in one way and I think about it in another, but we always assume, I guess, that there'll be a Jewish-Muslim element to it, or there might be, and we worry about that before the news comes through. Isn't that true?
Yeah, and whenever an attack happens now, David, in the world, my first instinct is to say nothing until I know the full facts. And I sent you some tweets over, didn't I, over the weekend when this was happening, where I said, my instinct was, what the F? Why are these people starting to assign blame and suggest that this attacker is Muslim? Because I think, like you, my heart always dips when I see an attack like this. First of all, for the victims, thinking, oh God, who is going to get hurt? But secondly, thinking, who is the perpetrator and what's going to be the fallout of all of this? Because it's almost like there's a whole bunch of people sat out there thinking, the minute an attacker is Muslim, well, this then gives them the green light to come out and start being all nasty and bigoted. And then there's another group of people who want the attacker to be a white extremist. And then there's another group of people who want the attacker to be Jewish. And we can all get into our tribes and then say, there you go, one of your tribes is being nasty.
The attacker is very rarely likely to be Jewish. The attacker, there might be some Israeli element to it, but it's very unlikely to be Jewish. But there is an element always of the attack involving Jews, that it's being done somehow in the name of the conflict. And so there's a fear. Straightforwardly, I can tell you, there's a fear that the more times that happens, the more you think, oh, this is eventually going to involve someone I know who's going to get killed, or I'm going to get killed, or whatever. That's how you feel as a Jew. But I would agree with you completely that there's a mad thing that happens whereby people want to say what it is before they know the information so that they can have their confirmation biases confirmed in advance. I did, in fact, say this on Twitter. What I then noticed was that after there was another attack in Sydney, a less serious attack, thank heavens, but in which a priest got attacked by someone who I think was chanting in Arabic afterwards, that was a religious attack, that they were then, those people saying, trying to own me and trying to say, oh, is it all right to say that this person is from a certain religion or whatever? And what I thought was astonishing about that is that those people were more concerned about owning me than about having any concern for any of the people who might be being hurt. But I would agree with you. Actually, one thing I don't think is said before is that whenever I see one of these attacks happening, and I particularly thought it with the Sydney attacker, is people want to ascribe this to some ethnic thing, and they do often want to say bad faith actors or whatever. They want to say it's a Muslim. What I always think is, do these people not know about incels? Do you know about incels?
I do. Okay. And actually, the attack that killed five women, the attacker's father was subsequently asked, why do you think he did this? And he said, I think he wanted a girlfriend and he couldn't because he had no social skills and he was really frustrated. So there is that kind of anti-woman, incel, ideological movement. But I do want to...
If anyone doesn't know, sorry, I think I should say...
Sorry.
If anyone doesn't know, an incel is a man, normally a young man. The word means involuntary celibate, and it's a group, it's a movement of young men who now believe that there's something politically that they can get engaged with, often violently, with the fact that, you know, they're not able to have sex with the women they want. A lot of people have been killed in actual massacres by incels or attempted massacres. By the way, I don't know if you'll agree with this, I'm of the opinion that almost every massacre has that component. Even if it's people saying, I'm doing this for religious reasons, I'll tell you why. It's always men doing this stuff. It's always men who are discontented, who are radicalised, and who almost definitely have got at least a sublimated sexual component in what they're doing.
The British Intelligence Service's Behavioural Sciences Unit, when it was looking at those people who are radicalised, looked at this, and they said one of the issues was this issue around confused sexuality, frustrated relationships, right, issues around domestic violence. So there is a kind of consistent pattern to this. But I think what really, and I'm going to use the word, what really pissed me off about this Australia issue and as it was unfolding was that here was the most tragic killing of women, an attack on a child. Actually, the only Muslim man who was involved in all of this was a security guard by the name of Faraz Tahir, a 30-year-old migrant from Pakistan who'd recently come to Australia, who was a security guard who stood in the way of this attacker and was actually killed as a result of it. But, you know, nobody wanted to mention that Muslim man who was involved in this. But what really pissed me off was that mainstream people who are in the public eye, like Julia Hartley Brewer and Rachel Riley, went out and said, effectively, call this for the Muslims. And Rachel Riley even connected it back to Palestine and the Intifada. And I just thought, what, in the middle of what is going on in the Middle East right now, and in the middle of these tense relationships often that can be between Jews and Muslims in this country and Muslims in other communities in this country. And you think either these people don't think or don't care. But both of them are worrying traits and characteristics if you're in public life. Being in public life means you have a responsibility to, as my mum says, use your ears twice and your mouth once. That's why God gave you two ears and one mouth. But the fact that this was tweeted out thousands and thousands of times afterwards and took on a life of its own. And in the end, I just thought, I'm not even going to respond. I'm not even going to engage. I'm not going to throw more fuel on this fire.
So obviously you're right, it was a very idiotic thing for those people to do, a function of course of social media, it's like so many things. Let's not forget, none of this would have happened, these things couldn't have happened in the time before social media. Social media creates a space where too many people have a voice, and particularly people want to get their voices in early when big things happen, because of course social media is just an incredibly narcissistic space where people want to be noticed and want to say stuff that will get noticed, and one of the ways of doing that is by saying something inflammatory on social media. One thing that might also be worth saying is by the time I caught up with this story, everyone on social media was saying it was a Jewish attacker or an Israeli attacker. In fact, there was a specific pro-Putin Australian commentator who had targeted a specific named Australian guy called Benjamin Cohen, who happened to be wearing the same football shirt as the attacker once. And that poor bloke was doxxed. He had his address put out online, and for about 24 hours, there was absolute conviction that he was the killer and his life would have been ruined for that time, which is just horrible.
I just think it's awful the way that, you know, I think it was Benjamin Cohen, wasn't he, who was attacked for this. And I really hope he sues the pants off all those that did put his name out there and goes on a really nice holiday, or maybe even retires off the back of it. Because there should be consequences, right? And the fact that people who put this stuff out are still on our news channels and are still holding down their jobs. And, you know, it just disturbs me. For me, what hurts more is when this stuff comes from the British Jewish community. Because I think, guys, of all the people who know what it's like to be on the receiving end of this rubbish, is you guys. So why do you dish it out?
Well, for a start, I don't like getting into very specific stuff about Twitter, because I think, you know what, I think it's beneath us. But in terms of Rachel, who I know, she has apologised, not particularly well, I don't think, because she's done about four tweets trying to explain why she said it, and she did link it to the Intifada in a kind of cack-handed way. She would say, I think, that she's felt under threat. I mean, she did say this for the last 6 months, since October the 7th. She talked a lot about not being able to go on the tube and all this stuff because she's frightened. And so in her mind, which by the way, I'd like to completely say I don't agree with this as a way of dealing with it. But in her mind, I think she's trying to say, oh, this is an example of what can happen when the threats that are coming out of the movement to support Gaza that feel to her as a Jew threatening, that then they can lead eventually to this kind of violence.
The only thing I can say to you, David, is that I, on a daily basis, because of the you know, political space that I inhabit see Islamophobia. It doesn't manifest as anti-Jewish racism. When I worry about Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism, I also then worry about everybody else's racism. And Rachel Riley, who got an OBE quite rightly for fighting anti-Semitism and who is an ambassador for countering hate, including the Center for Countering Digital Hate, she's an anti-racist campaigner. So when you're an anti-racist campaigner, you make damn sure that you don't do things that perpetuate racism and hatred towards any other community. That's part and parcel of it. You know, otherwise, we're not really anti-racist campaigners. We're just tribal people who are out just to talk about our own tribe.
I want to go there about something which I did mention. And it's partly because I felt it too. And I felt it, I think, partly because of this podcast. Right. I had made the point on Twitter that people, I think I said people who wanted to say before they knew the information that this killer was either Muslim or Jewish when he was neither of those things, just want to have their confirmation biases further confirmed. I did think, oh, a bit, when there was the stabbing in the church, right? It says that on the BBC that the Sydney police have confirmed it's a terrorist incident and it's a case of religious extremism. Now, I want to know how you felt about that. I want to know how you felt about having definitely and correctly felt that the smearing, as it were, of your identity by prominent people on Twitter because of the assumption that the Bondi killer was Muslim and related to the Gaza situation, that then when there was violence perpetrated by a Muslim in Australia very soon afterwards, how did that make you feel? You know, the news reports are saying things that are suggestive that the person involved in the stabbing of the priest is a Muslim. They haven't said that he's a Muslim. So I guess what I'd like to ask you is, are we still being Islamophobic if we assume that person is a Muslim now, with that information, or could it be a different type of religious extremism?
If a Muslim man kills somebody because he's doing it in the name of Islam, he's a terrorist. There's nothing Islamophobic about calling a terrorist a terrorist. I don't give a damn what his religious identity is. And by the way, by committing an act of terrorism, he's acting against his own faith anyway, because you can't take life in the name of faith randomly. And the one thing you can't do, actually, interestingly, there's a specific ruling on this. You can't kill priests. You can't kill other people of faith. So even in war, you're told not to kill women, children, people of faith. You know, priests and rabbis and vicars are off limits anyway, even in a war situation. Okay,
but the thing is, Saida, it happens, and it has happened in this case. And as far as I can make out, this probably was done in the name of Islam, because it's been called a case of religious extremism and it's been called an act of terrorism. So I guess in a way what I want to know is, like, how much do you feel the both things can be true thing, which we talk about a lot on this, which is that obviously it is wrong for people to rush to assume that someone who has done that kind of thing is a Muslim. At the same time, it does happen, particularly from young Muslim men.
Yeah, we need some statistics on this. Terrorism in the West has fallen to its lowest level in 15 years. You won't think that if you went on Twitter.
No, that's
interesting. To the Global Terrorism Index, it has. Listen to these numbers. There were 23 attacks recorded in the West in 2023. And that was a 55% drop from the previous year, lower than the peak of attacks, which was 2017. And at its peak, there were 176 attacks in the West. We magnify this in our heads in such a way that we lose all concept of what the actual figures are. You know, when I wrote my book, The Enemy Within, I looked at these statistics in the United States, and I come from a family of furniture makers. We make beds. And I said that if you look at the statistics, you're more likely to be killed at the hands of your furniture than you are by the hands of a religious extremist. You're more likely to kill yourself coming out of bed or have some wardrobe fall on you. You know, so I just think sometimes you've got to be, I'm being a bit facetious, but you have to put this into perspective. And what we've done, unfortunately, is we have magnified in our head this concept of the angry young Muslim man who goes around killing everybody and they're so uniquely violent compared to any other religion. It's simply not true. Because if it was, there are 2 billion Muslims in the world, David, we'd all be dead if that's who they were, if that's what they were like. We wouldn't be able to survive if that was the kind of baseline of Islam or baseline of Muslim men.
Yeah, I'm not really saying it. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying I agree with you that it's a stereotype. I'm asking you to accept that, you know, in the case of the stabber of the priest and some other occasions, you know, it is a thing that exists. You know, I'm absolutely prepared to accept that it's magnified, but it does also exist. And I think it's possibly useful to be able to own that as well as to attack the stereotype. By the way, I also think that if your family are good at selling beds and that's something that, you know, is a good business tradition in your family, you shouldn't go on about furniture killing people. That's not going to be at all good for your market. Have we covered it?
I think the other statistic, which I think is really interesting, is that of the 7 attacks that were recorded in the United States in 2023, 5 were linked to individuals with far-right sympathies or connections. So of the 7, 5 in the United States were far-right. And this is exactly what I found when I wrote my book, that overwhelmingly in the West, and specifically in the United States, terrorist attacks are done by extreme far-right, not by religious
members. And in the United States, you know, the vast amount of violence, which is not defined as terrorism, is just done by mad men who've got some terrible grievance, and then they decide to shoot up a high school or, you know, their place of work or whatever. I mean, and that stuff is much, much more likely to kill you in America than any form of terrorist attack. That's clearly the case.
And, you know, talking about, you know, men who have issues, it's actually quite a funny story. So during the heyday of ISIS, when young men were traveling from the UK to join ISIS, 2 young boys from Birmingham decided they wanted to go off and be part of this big gang, you know, ISIS, and have the big guns and the big cars. And when they decided to set off, it suddenly occurred to them that actually they knew nothing about Islam. They were just like 2 boys who wanted to go out and be part of the biggest gang. And they actually ordered from Amazon Islam for Dummies. And it was one of the pieces of evidence that led to their conviction. And often what you find is that these young men who want to be part of religious extremism and terrorism know bugger all about religion.
Of course. I mean, you know, almost all the ways in which young men have joined violent organisations over many years, it is more about those young men wanting to create for themselves a sense of heroism, nobility, destiny, and being part of something, as you said, giving themselves an identity beyond just being some nameless bloke from some backwater. It feels much more exciting and glamorous. And that is the real reason why men get involved in these things. It's very rarely, I think, anything to do with actual theology or whatever else it might be. While we're talking about theology, Pesach starts on Monday. It starts on Monday night. That is when Jews will be doing the Seder, which is the meal that they have. It's Passover. Do you know what Passover is, Saida?
I do know what Passover is, but I'm not going to try and be the expert when I've got you, the atheist Jew, in the room.
Yeah, well, I do know about it.
Are you going to get it wrong? And then loads of people are going to write in and say you got...
I'm actually not going to get this wrong. But it's a complicated one in a way, because it's about the way that the Jews who were enslaved in Egypt in Egyptian times left Egypt to go and travel with God's help to Israel, to the land of milk and honey. And so there'll be people out there who think that's the first example of the settler colonialists doing their thing, I imagine. And particularly because what we're meant to say on Pesach, what Jews are meant to say, is next year in Jerusalem, L'shana haba'ah Yerushalayim in Hebrew. And that, again, is probably a complicated thing to say right at the moment. Pesach does have very much is about the notion that Jews are indigenous to that particular place. But what we do basically is we have a big meal and then we eat a lot of unleavened bread, which is essentially a big cracker. There's a thing that Jews say when they sit down to any big festivals, which is they tried to kill us, they failed, let's eat. And that is what it means to be Jewish. Anyway, I wanted to say good Yontuf to you. I mean, this is going out on Thursday, but good Yontuf is what Jews say. Good as in just... Good is just good. That's not Hebrew. But Yontuf means like special day.
I tell you what I was going to ask about Passover, though. One of the things I read was that part of Passover was the fast of the firstborn. And that sounds very Game of Thrones. And I thought, could you explain that to me?
There's no fast of the firstborn. I think you've slightly got it wrong there. The Egyptians wouldn't let the Jews go. They'd kept them as slaves in Egypt. God came and created 10 plagues. And they're mainly slightly weird plagues because they include frogs, like a lot of frogs appeared from nowhere, which actually sounds like quite a laugh. And then there was, yeah, locusts were one of them. And then one of them was the angel of death passed over the houses of the Egyptians and all their firstborn sons were killed. So that's slightly less comedy. But all these plagues, apparently that's why the Egyptians eventually said, all right, you can go, get out of here.
Have I just made that up?
All right, so I've just checked it and Saida's bloody right, isn't she? Like, she so often is. It turns out there is a fast of the firstborn. It's the night before Passover. The firstborn child in a Jewish family, in memory of the Egyptians who were killed by the angel of death, is supposed to fast. No Jew's ever done that, I don't think, because we fast on Yom Kippur. That is enough for the whole year.
You know what, David? I'm actually going to fast on the day of the fast of the firstborn, just so I can gaslight my elder sister, who always thinks I'm trying to behave like the firstborn when she is. I'll send her a little picture.
Okay, I bet you're not, because, you know, Ramadan was difficult enough for you. Next week, we might be doing another question and answer episode, so please send us questions again on podcast@instinctproductions.com. That's the email, podcast@instinctproductions.com.
Or on Twitter @AMuslimAndAJew.
Muslim and a Jew, Go There was brought to you by Instinct Productions.